There's a place and a need for that. And my prayer, as Glenn prayed, would be that God would bless the efforts in this area and your participation in it. You might want to be turning to Matthew 24 and 25. We'll be looking really at both chapters there. And as Steve has noted, we will be covering the sheep and the goats, which is the very last, if you want to call it a parable, but a description of events that Jesus gives right there at the end of chapter 25. But it will be helpful to know the context of this, the time in Jesus' ministry in which this teaching occurred, as well as the run-up to this in terms of the actual teaching. The sheep and the goat seems to be a part of a unit, and I'll try to prove that to you as we talk, that builds on a foundation of about five parables, true parables. You'll recognize them. They're very familiar to us. And I think they form the context of understanding the statement about the sheep and the goats. I will probably slip up and call it the parable of the sheep and the goats. But really, Jesus just says at the end of time, he'll separate them like sheep and goats. It's not really a story so much about that. But still, it's the sixth in a series. So if you want to think about it, the first five parables that we'll look at are a kind of an introduction. So you may be thinking that the end is a long way off, right? Here's my apocalyptic statement about that. So when I finally get to asking the question, who are the goats? The end is near. Okay, I'm nearly done. Let him who reads understand. And so anyway, that's it. But it'll seem like a long introduction because I think we need to see these five stories that Jesus talks about leading up to the sheep and the goats message, and then we'll talk about what that actually means. The context in Matthew 24 is that it follows Matthew 23, which is where Jesus, after all those questions that they tried to trick him with, and he just basically turned it on them and asked them questions they couldn't answer, he begins a scathing set of criticisms and condemnations for the scribes and Pharisees. You're familiar with chapter 23. Woe unto you, hypocrites! And he talks about all the things that they do, which demonstrate the evil, really, the non-genuineness of their faith. But then, at the beginning of chapter 24, here this text is on the screen, then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, you see, this is a different setting. He's not in the temple and not with the Pharisees and scribes. He's done with that, although it's apparently the same day. Skip over to chapter 26. I think the second verse, Jesus says, yet 2 days, and it's the Sabbath, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified. So that's, I don't know, that's either Wednesday or Thursday. You figure it out, but before the crucifixion, okay? Just a couple of days. But he's with his disciples now on the Mount of Olives. The disciples came to him privately. Did you hear that? That's important. Saying, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Now, I know there's controversy about these chapters and what events they describe. It seems to me that the best interpretation, although it's not without difficulty, is that they've really kind of asked two things without even knowing it, but they've asked about when is it that the temple rocks will be thrown down and what will be the sign of the end of the age. Maybe those are two separate questions. Maybe in their mind they thought it was all the same. I don't really know, but it appears that Jesus answers two questions. And so when you go on down to verse 33, after a discussion of the destruction of Jerusalem, which is the stones being thrown down, it appears that he turns the topic to the end of the age. He says, see also, when you see all these things, know that it's near, at the doors. Do you see a little contrast there? Because you know he's going to say in all these parables, you don't know when the end's going to be. It's a thief in the night. But here he's saying, watch for all these things, and then you'll know the end is near. You see what I mean? So it sounds like there's a change of topic that's about to happen here. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. And now he makes a reference to the passing away of heavens and earth. But of that day and hour, No one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. You see that it appears he's changing the topic there. And if that's not sufficient evidence, I think when we look through these parables, you will see that there's a sense of global justice. I mean, all the nations are, and the sheep and goats are called before the Son of Man sitting on his throne with his angels. There's kind of a universal picture of that. And they're thrown into everlasting darkness and cut in half and a bunch of other things like that, which appears to be a little bit different. Furthermore, this accounting of the talents or the bridegroom coming and the 10 or 5 foolish virgins don't have their oil, that doesn't sound like the judgment on the Jewish nation for their unfaithfulness to me. It seems like it's a turning of the topic more to a global judgment on mankind. So I'm going to start there then in verse 36 and go forward and look at these pictures of the end of time, assuming that's what they are. And then one last caveat, if that's not what it is, and you can somehow demonstrate to yourself that this is still discussing the destruction of Jerusalem, which some do, I would still say the warnings still apply. This is what you do when God's judgment is not. And I don't think it matters to some extent which interpretation you take with regard to how we prepare, right? This is a lesson for us, even if it's about the Jews at that time, but it can be applied to us. I'm sorry for that excursion. It's just, there's some other teaching. I think it's false teaching, but I'm trying to make sure that you understand why I'm approaching it the way I do. So there are 6 lessons, and really they're not about the end of time primarily. They all end with the end of time, but you might notice that they're really mostly about what happens before the end of time. What are you doing during that time? How are you thinking? How busy are you? How are you treating those who for whom you have responsibility? You see what I'm talking about? You'll see what I mean as we go. Furthermore, I think each of these parables builds on the previous one, adding a new idea, adding some more detail that really gives all the ones before more meaning and leads us up to the parable of the sheep and the goats. The first one is, he says in chapter 24, verse 37, that those days will be like the days of Noah. And for the sake of time, I'm not going to read each of these, okay, because I think you know these. But he says, we will read the one about the sheep and the goats. But the thing about Noah is people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until all of a sudden Noah went in the ark and the flood came. They had no idea. They were totally unprepared, unexpecting, bewildered, surprised. And by the way, surprise is a theme through all these as well. People being surprised at what actually happens at the end and the fate of some. And he notes that some are taken and some are not. He talks about men in a field working together, women at a mill grinding together. Do you imagine that those two men in the same field knew each other? Do you think they might have even been like father and son or brothers or neighbors working together? Is that, it seemed likely to me, right? And the two women working together at the mill, do you think they were sisters or mom and daughter, or they were familiar people, neighbors at least, working together, and yet one was taken and one was not, suggesting that there was kind of a surprise, and people who really were related to each other, that didn't determine which way they went, if you will, right? It didn't matter what family they were in or where they lived, it was more what they had been doing. Of course, we don't see that quite in that parable. It's just warning us to close relationships really might represent, don't really represent the same fate. But the message, he seems to me, when he gets to verse 42 there is, you have to therefore watch. And here's the difficulty. You understand that they're eating and drinking. Do you all eat and drink every day? Ordinary? Does it consume somewhat of our attention to prepare the food and eat and clean up and all that? It does. We also marry and give, is that's an ordinary thing too. Do you see that the ordinary things often make us forgetful about this faith that's coming? I think that's his point. Yeah, I get all tight, especially if I've ever been to a wedding. I don't think about the judgment day. Do you? I suspect the bride and groom, it kind of maybe doesn't pass through their head unless the preacher mentions it somehow, right? But really that, so the events of our life, he's almost saying, you got to find a way to ignore the ordinary each day. And think about the judgment. Think about the end that's coming, just like those people in the days of Noah needed to be thinking about. Why is Noah building this ark? What's he getting in the ark for? And kind of ignore the eating and drinking and other ordinary things. So that's a difficult thing. But basically he just says to watch. Ignore the ordinary. I put that in there, but I think that's the point. And watch. He says to watch. Now, the next story you know, he says it's like a thief coming in the night. And he'll come at a time when you do not expect. If he's a good thief, he'll be really good at picking the time when you don't expect him, right? He won't pick a time that you kind of always are watching. He'll pick a time you just never thought someone would come at that. And it's a surprise. And basically he says, if the master had known, I'm trying to remember the exact term, if the master had known, he would have prepared for the thief, right? Let me see, I'm on the wrong page here. He would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Do you sense that the master wasn't just watching and expecting, ignoring the ordinary and expecting as in the first parable, he was actually getting ready. He's not going to allow the guy in. He got some extra bolts for the door. Maybe he did some other things to prepare himself for that thief coming. You see what he did? He did more than watch. He got ready. And I think that's the message of the thief. In addition to the surprise, right? That's the way Jesus will come. The next parable is interesting to me because it kind of gives a picture. And the word in the Greek is slaves. But there's a slave, but who's also a ruler. That's an interesting, almost paradox. But it's a window into the kind of relationships that people had in those days. And the ruler just gives the slave total authority. You're in charge. I'm out of here. And he's to give the servants their food in their season. He can do whatever he wants. In fact, he demonstrates he can do whatever he wants because an evil version of that servant, you know, abuses the servants, and he goes and gets drunk with those that are outside. So he can do that. Nobody's there stopping him. He has total authority over the master's house. And he has a choice. He can do what the master says, be diligent in helping the other servants, slaves in the house, get their food, do their work, and not abuse the opportunity. Or he can say, in fact, he does say in verse 48, the evil one says, my master is delayed in coming. Now, do you see, we've introduced a new theme. Yes, watch. Yes, watch and be ready, prepare. But there's another theme introduced here, and that is there might be a delay here. You might have to wait a while. And this servant apparently is thinking to himself, well, I'll just do what I want to for a while. My master's delayed, and maybe, and I'm already sticking this in there, but I think this is the way I'd think about it. I'll fix things up before he gets back. We ever think that way? I'll live that way now, but since the master's delaying, I'll fix it up later. Maybe when I get older, maybe in a few weeks, maybe when I get done with the sins that I'm enjoying right this minute or the worldliness that's important to me. I'll fix it up later. That delay then is basically an opportunity then for him to do that, maybe with some idea in his head that he can fix it up later. So his choice is to obey or to abuse others, indulge in pleasure and so on. I think the message then is that you need to work now. Don't delay. Don't count on the master's delay. You need to start doing what you're doing right this minute because guess what? Verse 50, the master of the servant will come on a day when he's not looking for him. See that theme of surprise again, right? And an hour that he's not aware of. So it looks like the delay is just, you're just trapping yourself to do that. That's what that message seems to be. So you see how we're building here? Be ready, be aware, ignore the ordinary if you have to. Be prepared like a thief. Just be ready, do what you need to do to prepare. Don't delay thinking you can fix it later. Start right this minute and keep working. You see how these are building a little bit as we go forward. Now the next story we know pretty well, and that's the wise and foolish virgins. And a little bit about the wedding ceremony. I guess the groom, who is the star of the wedding in those days, as opposed to the bride, I think. But he goes to the home of the bride or somewhere, and he gets the bride, and there's celebrations there. And later he will bring his bride back to his own home, or maybe his parents' home, or wherever they're going to live maybe, I don't know, but to another place. Well, that procession then would collect the invited guests along the way, and they would then be a part of this ceremony at the home of the groom with his new bride that he's brought. Well, the celebration at the bride's home was unpredictable, and it might go on. In fact, verse 5 of chapter 25, but while the bridegroom was delayed, big surprise, right? We don't know when he's coming. And the virgins who were waiting, they're invited guests along the way. You think of them as bridesmaids if you want. I don't know if that's exactly the same. But they fell asleep. Now, they're not the five wise virgins fell asleep too. That's not the point. The point of sleeping is it was taken a while. It was taken a long time. And of course, again, same theme, a surprise at midnight. Can you imagine at midnight they're going to have the wedding ceremony? A surprise again. And yet they come. Now, what's the message of that? Well, it seems to me that not only can we expect the delay, did you hear that from the last one? But we ought to be working with that delay in mind. That's a strange thing to think about. I ought to be preparing for that delay in my mind. I think it might take a while. And what was wrong with the five foolish virgins is not that they weren't invited to the wedding. It wasn't that they had on the wrong garment. That's a different parable. Y'all know about that, right? The problem they had is they were not preparing for a wait. You see that? That's the whole thing. That's all there was. And when it was a delay, they ran out of gas, if you will. Oil in this case. And I'm reminded of the passage in Hebrews 12. It says we're to run with patience, endurance, the race that's set before us. Why is the Hebrew writer telling those Jewish Christians that? Because it might be a long time and you've got to have endurance. You've got to be set for the long term. Do you know how we live differently when we know something is not tomorrow, it's a few weeks away, or we expect it will be a while? We just live differently. And you might even think about things in your own personal life and our relationship with others and the work in the church for that matter. If we think there's a delay or if we're preparing for a delay, by the way, don't forget, it will be a surprise. So it might not be, but the point is prepare for a delay, mentally at least, with endurance. So you see how we're building these up? Right? Watch. Be prepared. Right? As, you know, don't let that thief come in the night. Do your work now. Don't think you can fix it later. And prepare for a wait. Prepare for a wait. One more. And I think we know this one quite well too. And that is talents were given to, again, slaves. And we'll talk about how much money they got as slaves. By their master who went on a journey to a far country. In fact, it says in verse 19, he was gone for after a long time. You get the theme there? It's a long time. Long wait. I hope these themes are kind of combining to see the picture of how these five things fit together. He gave them a large sum of money. You probably know that a talent in the English has come to us by a twisty chain of etymology all the way back to talentos, which is the Greek word used here. Talentos is a measure of weight, like ounces, pounds, tons. It's that kind of a unit. In the Greek, he gave them two talentos, one talentos, or five. Now, I want you to know what a talent, it's over 60 pounds is what a talent in Greek would mean. And if it's gold, and I looked this up last night, I don't remember all the numbers, it seemed like it was $1,800 an ounce right now. That's all right. I do remember the final math though. It's a one talent is about $1.8 million if it's gold. So that amount of gold. In fact, there's a story of you remember Elisha's servant Gehazi, and he healed Naaman. And he said, I don't want your stuff. Elisha did. But Gehazi said, well, wait, I'll take some of that. He got two talents from the guy. It took two men to carry it. If you go read that account in 2 Kings. So it's a lot of stuff. It's a weighty thing. If it's gold, it's almost $2 million. That's one talent. That's what the one talent man got. Now, you know, all the inflation. But it's a lot of money. And five is a lot, okay? They had a lot to do. And so a large sum was given, and their choice was to go trade and invest and increase the value over time. So now we've actually built on this idea of preparing for a delay to investing in the delay. Grow something, right? Use the time to be productive, to build something up. You see, that's the message of the talents, isn't it? In fact, the master says to the one talent man, you could have at least taken my money, by the way, money, he calls it money later in the text, because that's what it is. And given it to the bankers. You're supposed to be helping me stay behind. The bankers, you might bring in $1 million to them and say, I want to invest this here, but they don't just give you money right then. Are you aware of that? I mean, it might be a pretty nice, you know, CD or money market account or mutual fund or whatever, but they don't give you the money the day you show up. You have to wait. It has to grow. It has to kind of you know, be productive, and the interest has to accrue over a period of time. Do you see that? And do you see that in our lives, we're preparing for the delay, but we're also trying to be productive during that delay? And do you see that we would live totally differently if we thought the Lord was coming tomorrow? Wouldn't you? Right? I don't think you'd be worried about, you know, finding a preacher. What's the point of that? There's no need. You'd be worried about the Bible class program here. You wouldn't be training the young people how they should live when they grow up, would you? They're not going to grow up. The Lord is coming tomorrow. In our own personal study, we might not be challenged. Hey, what can I learn in a day, right? I don't need to study real hard. You know, it's almost to the end here. Do you see the different attitude we'd have about self-development, about children, about the church, about why would you train preachers to go overseas? They'd never get there, right? We'd have a totally different view. And yet this parable is saying, no, there is a delay. Don't know how long. Use that delay to be productive and make something that will grow over time and make the kingdom expand. You see how all these have grown from the first thing to say, don't neglect the fact that Jesus is coming one day because of the ordinary events, all the way down to, no, expect the delay and work during that time. Do something productive. And they actually build on that lesson. Okay, so those are the five parables that kind of introduce, I think, then the sheep and the goats. But there really is a break there, and I'm going to read some of this in Matthew chapter 25, that seems to be announcing this. So, I'm sorry, my thoughts are not quite as organized. Do you see how so far we really haven't talked too much about the end of time? Now, I understand the servants are punished at the end of these stories, but the stories are really about what to do in the meantime, before the end of time. Now, in here in chapter 25, when we start in verse 31, we're going to hear about, I think, the end of time. And again, I can't read this and make the destruction of Jerusalem out of it. Sorry, I didn't mean to get back on that. But it's just to me, it doesn't read that way. But it does frighten me. And you'll know a little bit more why later. When the Son of Man comes in His glory, and all the holy angels with Him, then He will sit on the throne of His glory. All the nations will be gathered before Him, and He will separate them one from another as the shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. He will set the sheep on His right hand, but the goats on the left. And Steve, I don't know if that's as the audience is right and left or the speaker's right and left, but anyway. Then the King will say to those on His right hand, come, you blessed of My Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, you gave Me food. I was thirsty, you gave Me drink. I was a stranger, you took Me in. I was naked, and you clothed Me. I was sick, and you visited Me. I was in prison, and you came to Me. Then the righteous will answer Him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or a naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? The King will answer and say to them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these My brethren, you did it to Me. Then you will also say to those on the left hand, depart from Me, you cursed, into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. And then He repeats the same incidents of being hungry and thirsty and prison and sick and all that, and naked. And He just says, you didn't do it. You didn't help Me. There I was, and you didn't help Me. Verse 44, then they will also answer Him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not minister to you? And He will answer them, saying, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of these, the least of these, you did not do it to Me. And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. So what you see here is a glorious scene, the very first verses. It's worldwide. It's the Son of Man, maybe a reference to Daniel's picture of the Son of Man coming on the clouds. He's sitting on a throne. All the nations are there. And then there's a two-way division like sheep and goats. And again, parable or not, I don't know. He uses the imagery. But I want to talk about that imagery for a minute. Do you understand that sheep and goats often graze together, maybe even under the same shepherd, right? They were in a group. Why did He have to separate them? Right? But they came in the evening. Maybe the sheep have to go one way for their food and the goats another. Maybe shearing, the sheep go one way and the goats go for the milk. I don't know what. But you know, there's a time when they need to be separated, the sheep from the goats. And you can imagine them coming in fairly compliant and the shepherd just directs them, you know, one way or the other to his left hand and to his right hand. It's a really a picture of just a separation, a sorting, if you will, of really a single flock, in my opinion. And then he pronounces the verdicts, verses 34 and 41. And you'll notice the verdicts are very parallel to each other. He says, come, verse 34, blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom. In verse 41, he says, depart, not come, you cursed, not blessed, into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. So quite a different fate, but they're parallel to each other as he does that. And then he explains why that's so. And it's based on the service to the king, verses 35 and 42. You're familiar with this, but I think we need to see the facts to understand it. Before I go into those details, I want to raise some questions that we will answer, two questions that I think it's important for us to face in light of a kind of our current culture about this. And I will address the first one fairly directly and the second one right at the end, really. The first question is this. Does Jesus' description of this sorting of sheep and goats, obviously some are lost and some are saved, right? That's pretty clear, no matter what your interpretation of it, the whole thing would be. Does that describe the entirety of the gospel? Y'all know what I'm saying by that? In other words, are men judged only based on meeting the physical needs of others? Right? I mean, are they generous? Are they feeding the hungry around the world? Are they helping the sick? Are they visiting those who are in prison for whatever reason? And that's the only thing that Jesus will judge men for at the end of time. Y'all are all shaking your head. No, but I'm telling you, read the parable. Is there anything else mentioned as a criteria for judgment there? Okay? I mean, this is not. And I just want you to know, you probably know already, that this is a key text of the social gospel, right? And so the idea is that you, really Jesus has one criteria. Are you kind and generous to those who are in need? To those who are, you know, disadvantaged in some way? To those that are sick or disabled or in jail for whatever reason they're in jail, right? And so if you do that, you're acceptable no matter what you believe religiously or what you practice religiously or morally other than the benevolence that is required. You see how someone could read this text and get that idea? So that's the first question. And I want to illustrate the way this position is held. And this is a quote from a guy named Frederick Buchner. I don't know who he is. I was just fishing around online looking at various comments on this text. And I found this one. I thought, well, that's kind of my point, that people do think that. And I will read it to you. So this is what this man, Reverend Frederick Buchner, says. Thus, for Jesus, the only distinction between men and that ultimately matters seems to be not whether they're churchgoers or non-churchgoers, right? Communists or capitalists, Catholics or Protestants or Jews. By the way, don't believe in the Messiah or the atoning work of Jesus or anything, right? That doesn't matter. But do they or do they not love? Love not in the sense of an emotion so much as in the sense of an act of will, the loving act of willing another's good, even if need arise at the expense of our own. You see what he's saying there? This is it. The main thing. It's not the religion, right? It's not even your belief in Jesus as the Messiah. It is whether you're acting out this love of others in terms of benevolence, of course. And he says, hell, and this is a quote from Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov. There's an old father, I think a priest of some kind, Zosima, in there, and he's kind of the voice of wisdom, of philosophy. But he said this, hell is the suffering of being unable to love. Just as Jesus appeared at his birth as a helpless child that the world was free to care for or destroy, so now he appears in his resurrection as the pauper. The prisoner, the stranger, appears in every form of human need that the world is free to serve or to ignore. You see the point that's being made there? Now, I'll say a little bit more about the social gospel, and you notice some things I've underlined. The history of the social gospel goes back well over a century, maybe almost two, but the idea of that is that all these things about the supernatural, virgin birth, miracles, resurrection, all of those things really are just legends that are put there. They inform us, they're allegories for us to understand, but really they're not true in the sense of being facts. Not only that, the whole idea of sin and atonement and all that, that's just a religious construction that grew up over time as well. Not only that, the whole idea of heaven and hell is kind of a fiction as well, or an allegory. And at best, what we should be reading into the text is that heaven is a goal. It's a state of utopia that we should all be working for to make this world into, right? By solving the social problems of mankind. I don't know if you're aware of that, but that is the social gospel. And, of course, religions, especially Christian religions, once you emasculate them, if you want to call it, I don't know what the word would be, you know, by taking out miraculous and taking out atonement and taking out heaven and hell and taking out literal inspired scripture, once you've taken that out, what are they left with, really, to offer to the world? And so the answer had to be, well, we're here to solve the problems of mankind. And so, therefore, the social gospel was a replacement so they could keep the doors open and the contributions coming in, right? They'd have a mission, a purpose, and the religion could continue. And this text, no surprise, is one of their key texts, right? I mean, this is what it says. Jesus just said, you didn't help the hungry and feed the poor and all that. And so you didn't do it to me, and that's the whole thing. And if you did do it, you go to heaven. If you didn't, then you go to hell. In fact, that's really the second question. I want to, I pushed the wrong button. The second question is that describing a salvation by works and a condemnation for lack of works? Again, another false teaching that we're saved somehow by being good enough, right? Or have enough good to outweigh the bad that we have, and therefore God judges us. It sounds like that, doesn't it, though? If you do all that stuff, you're in. If you don't do it, you're out in this text here. So these are a couple questions I want to talk about as we go ahead and look at it in more particular. With regard to the first question, is this the entirety of the gospel? That is, to solve social problems on this earth. Is that what Jesus came to do? Right? So let's, you know, you'd think that Matthew, even if you thought he wasn't inspired, wouldn't write contradictory stuff in his own letter, right? So I think it's easy to see in the context of this text, what we've seen so far, Matthew as a whole, not to mention the whole Bible, but I'm going to try to limit my discussion of context just to Matthew itself. What is the message of Matthew? Just go back a little bit, chapter 18, for the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. And if you look at the context of that, the verses before, he's talking about not sinning. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, your right eye, pluck it out, cut it off. That doesn't sound like social good to me. It says, sounds like there might be suffering, personal suffering involved. Why? So I don't sin. That's the thing. Jesus came to seek and save the lost. That's what Matthew 18 is. And if you cause a little one to stumble, same chapter, terrible, right? And that's a terrible fate. Millstone, thrown into the sea, that kind of thing. If you go back to Matthew 9, there's an interesting event. It's also recorded in other accounts. Jesus actually heals a paralytic. He says, take up your bed and go to your house. But before he says that, you know what he said? Remember that? He says, your sins are forgiven. And then the pressure dropped in the room as everyone inhaled all together. How can he say that? Do you understand that the miracle of raising the man, healing the man, was subordinate? It was less important than the other thing he said, which was, your sins are forgiven, but so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority to forgive sins, I'm going to tell him to take up his bed and go to your house, or whatever he says. You see that? Now, wait a minute. I thought Jesus came to solve social problems. Well, yes, he actually fed people and he healed people, but what was the purpose of that? Here, we learn from Jesus, it was to demonstrate that he had the authority to tell us to go feed hungry people. No, to forgive sins. That's the point in Matthew. Matthew 26, which is, we already heard, this is only 2 days before the Passover, so I'm guessing a day and a half later from this very thing, Jesus institutes the Lord's Supper and says, this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many. For what? The remission of sins. You see, the spiritual side of this is the whole purpose of what his mission is. And he's headed to the cross right after this. He goes to the garden and is arrested and ends up on the cross before that, the next day. Matthew 28, then, as he is resurrected, and the last thing he says to his disciples there in the book of Matthew, go therefore and feed the hungry of all the world. Go therefore and solve the social problems of the nation. Is that what he says? Go therefore and invent vaccines that will keep us all from ever being sick again. And by the way, just a side point, do you realize that's a pretty hopeless task? I know it's a different context. Jesus said, the poor you have with you always. And I'll tell you what, I think we haven't solved death yet. Or disease. And somehow this idea that we're healing all these people and preventing death, I don't really think we are preventing death in, say, in this pandemic. We're postponing it for a few people, I suppose, right? But really, it's not solved. But Jesus doesn't tell us to do that, thankfully, because it just seemed like that would be hard to do. But I can do this. He says, make disciples, baptizing them. We learn from Acts 2 that that related to the remission of sins. In the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you. Which, by the way, probably does include being generous in our giving, in kind to people and all of that. But that isn't the message of Matthew and certainly isn't the foundation for judgment at the end of time. I have to say a little bit about Matthew 10. I think, and this is just a theory, I hope maybe it's not too crazy, but Matthew 10 was a little bit of a dry run for the 12. He chose the 12 there at the beginning of Matthew 10 and sent them out on what we sometimes call the limited commission to the lost sheep of Israel. Remember that? Not to Samaritans, not to the Gentiles. Go to the Jews. But he kind of describes how this is going to be. And it's going to be hard. I'm sending you out as sheep in the midst of, remember this, wolves. Right? Sheep in the midst of wolves. And he says that, you know, you're going to be persecuted and all of that. It's going to be kind of hard. In fact, it's in that chapter that he talks about the fact that I'll be setting a mother against her daughter-in-law. Does that sound familiar? A family member against another family member in the preaching of the gospel? Have we already talked something about that before? This idea that families might be separated. Not unified, not social ills solved, but rather actually causing division and suffering on the earth. So if you look at Matthew 10, look at the social impact of the gospel. Do not think I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. I came to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies shall be those of his own household. I asked you again, we saw that earlier, didn't we? In the discussion about the mill and the field. Taken. Down to verse 37. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy. He who finds his life will lose it. He who loses his life for my sake will find it. Does this read like we're improving the state of physical things on the earth? Or perhaps moving the other direction, even in our own personal lives? You see that? And I want to look at especially at the works themselves. Not only the works, but the object, the beneficiaries of the work. The king will answer and say to them, this is back to Matthew 25, I'm sorry again, just back in the text we were supposed to be looking at. The king will answer and say to them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these my brethren, you did it unto me. Who are my brethren here? I mean, Jesus had, I guess, half brothers and sisters. Matter of fact, that comes up in Matthew 2 also. Sorry, it's Matthew 12, but Matthew as well. While he was still talking to the multitudes, behold, his mother and brother stood outside seeking to speak with him. Then one said to him, look, your mother and your brothers are standing outside seeking to speak with you. But he answered and said to the one who told him, who is my mother and who are my brothers? And he stretched out his hand toward the disciples and said, here are my mothers and my brothers. Whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother. You see, Jesus identifies his family as disciples. And that seems to be who he's referring to in Matthew 25. To the least of these, my brethren. And he also says, you did it to me. And that's an interesting thing where Jesus identifies himself with those who benefited from those gifts. You remember the story when Paul, Saul, at that time, was on his way to Damascus, and he got kind of blinded and interrupted on the road, and the voice, Jesus's voice, came to him and said, I'll just read it. Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Well, the text there, if you read, says he was he was going to persecute the Christians, if you go back to the verses before. It says that, persecute the Christians, the church. But the voice said, you're persecuting me. And he said, well, who are you, Lord? And the Lord said to him, I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. Now, wait, Jesus was in heaven. He had already ascended and gone back. Do you see that Jesus identifies himself with his people, the body of his people? So that kind of explains the fact that you did it unto me as well. Now, I'm sorry, we're going to go back to Matthew 10 again, because I think the very same principle is taught here in this dry run, if you will, when the 12 apostles were sent out to preach, to have that experience about being told what to say and facing the persecution and finding a few people who will take them in their homes and support them because they are preaching the gospel. Remember that part of the instructions? If somebody has you in, you stay with them, right? And you take what they're able to give you. Matthew 10, 40 and 42. He who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. He who receives a prophet in the name of a prophet. And that seems a little strange construction, but in the Greek, what that probably means is he receives a prophet because of his work, because he is a prophet, because the work he's doing is good and valuable. And that's the motive. It's not like I like the guy a lot, he just happens to be a prophet and I gave him some money. No, I may not even like him, but he's a prophet and I'm going to help him. And for that reason, right, you're receiving me as well. Does this sound familiar? Receiving me, receive in mind. He who receives a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. And whoever gives one of these little ones only a cup of cold water in the name of a disciple, because he's a disciple, right? Assuredly I say to you, he shall by no means lose his reward. Doesn't this sound familiar? Doesn't it seem like almost like a commentary in a way on what this story about the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25 is about? And that is treating other members of our family as if they were Jesus and giving them the needs that they have. And so it's interesting. He starts with a prophet and then a righteous man, which I assume maybe isn't inspired, doesn't have a great mission. But then he gets down to little ones, down to just a cup of cold water in this thing. And remember in Matthew 25, he says, the least of these, my brethren. What is the least of these? What could that mean? Least of these. Well, I don't think he's saying exclude the ones that are prophets, because he says here to cover that. But I think he's talking about those who struggle the most. They might be the weakest. They might be what are perceived to be the least important. They might have the less wealth. They're the least likely to have me over to their house after I invite them to my house, using Jesus' other teaching. You see what I mean? They might not even be very likable, right? But they're his disciples. The least of these, my brethren. These little ones, children can be ornery sometimes too, but that doesn't mean we don't help them and take care of them and so on. So, here's a passage from Hebrews chapter 6. For God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love, which you have shown toward his name, okay, again, in that you have ministered to the saints and do minister. You see that our role as members of the flock of God is part of it, maybe a really important part, is our care for one another. And in doing that, we are serving Jesus. And the least of each other, the ones who have the most problems, the ones that are perhaps the least likable, the ones who have the least spiritual maturity, that's kind of what he's saying here. I think that's what the parable is really about. Now, is that the entirety of the gospel? I don't think so. But he is emphasizing, as Jesus often does, something that's so important, but we neglect to think about it. And that is, when we come before him in that day, we will be judged on how we treated the least of these, my brethren. Did you hear that? That's what he actually said. Our treatment of one another. Okay, you hear that? Who are the goats? The end is near. Who are the goats? Do you understand that in all these parables, I'm so glad that'll be gone next Sunday. Do you understand that in these parables, the virgins were invited to the wedding? They were in. They were friends. Do you understand that the servant who abused his fellow servants, he was important. He was the most important person in the master's house. Did you hear that? And the talents, they were servants of the master and given lots of money in his service. Do you understand? This is not the parable of the sheep and the wolves, right? It's the sheep and the goats. They existed together in the flock, and the master watched them. And at the end, he judged them, even though they had been leaders, right? And given great blessings and given great responsibility in the kingdom, in his household, to do things. And they are part of the same flock, but yet at the end of time, he says, depart from me. Go be with the devil and his angels. And by the way, pretty striking penalties for these people. One guy was going to be cut in half and given a place with the hypocrites. I'm thinking I might be able to stand the hypocrites, but I mean, pretty terrible fate for these people. Do you see what I'm saying with this? So who are the goats? Look at the punishment. I've just listed a few here. And know that the message was privately delivered on the Mount of Olives to the disciples. This is not the harangue of the scribes and Pharisees in chapter 23. Do you see that? He's talking to disciples privately. The disobedient were all in fellowship with the master and had great responsibility in almost every case. Jesus doesn't divide them as sheep and wolves, which he talks about in Matthew 10. They're living in the midst of dangerous wolves, but they're part of one flock. Who are the goats? Maybe a more important question is, could we be a goat? Sitting here this morning, faithful in attendance, could we be goats? Now, you always hear this parable. It's talking about all those atheists and immoral, you know, cruel people and criminals. And those are the goats, right? I don't think that's what Jesus is saying. He surprises us to say, yes. Yes, you could be the goats based on the way that we treat one another. Now, with regard to the second question, in conclusion, I just want to say this. One of the themes we've seen through this thing is surprise. The master or the thief or whoever comes and surprises everybody. We're thinking he's delayed and he'll come at a time when he does not know. And there's a surprise here. But I don't think here, I don't find it in the text. It could be true. This is 50% probability. It doesn't appear that they're that surprised about how they're divided. Do you notice that? Maybe they're making excuses with you, but we didn't have it. But the righteous are just as surprised as the unrighteous, right? The sheep are just as surprised as the goats. It's not that one is on the left and one's on the right. Maybe the goats kind of realize they should be there. But they have a little dialogue with the master about that. And what is a surprise to them is the significance that the Lord, the master, places on service to the least of the brethren. Do you see that? It's not you didn't do enough good works. In fact, the righteous are, they're just actually shocked. We didn't do anything to deserve this. We never saw you in prison or had a chance to rescue you. All we did was just help our brethren because they're family. The sheep think they're not worthy to sit at Jesus' right hand for so little done in life. When did we even have opportunity to do something great? And that says something about their attitude, doesn't it? If someone is in my family, especially a child or someone I have responsibility for, the care of, it is not a burden to me or a great thing that I go and try to help them. I buy groceries for my kids. I don't think about that as a huge burden every day. That's just something I do because it's family. You see, this is what Jesus is saying. And the righteous are so surprised by, oh, you mean that was important? Well, I did that because I just do that. I like that. They're my family. That's the way I should treat my brethren. You see that? They're surprised at that. And I think in some ways that's the answer to, is this a salvation by works or something? No. In fact, I'll read this as a conclusion and then I'll let you have the lesson. As I said, the end is near when you get to the, who are the goats. We express our love for our spiritual family in acts of kindness that are so natural and easy for us that we're surprised now and on the judgment day at the significance that Jesus places on them. Do you see that lesson in this parable? Yeah, so we need to be thinking about the judgment day. Expect it. Be prepared for it. Expect a delay. Prepare for the delay, invest in the delay. But you see, now the context is all the work we do together as a family. And the least of my brethren are those that are the most important in our care and our work, which is actually serving the master. Thank you. We'll have a song of invitation after a little bit. And if you need to do something in a public way, I would encourage you to do that at that time. There's a little setup required.
The song will be number 270. Number 270.